Let me start with a short introduction with respect to our dear guest, Franco Moretti. When I first met him in September 2014, it was on a special day. He had invited me to lunch, to have lunch in his home since, as he wrote, he's a reasonable cook. But then he wrote me that he would be delayed and had to take me to a nearby restaurant instead because he had got stuck in the Apple store. As I said, it was a special day, the day when the iPhone 6 was released. I only knew some biographical raw data about Franco Moretti, born and raised in Italy, studies in Rome, then professor at Columbia University, and finally, since 2000, at Stanford University, the very hub of internet startups in the Bay Area. So my famous assumption was that being the high priest of digital humanities, he might be one of those geeks who couldn't live a single day without having the brand new device in his head, in his hand. However, it turned out that he had gone to the Apple store for a very different reason. His son, somehow like this, had been using his MacBook while drinking at the same time from a bottle of water. As might be expected, this was a risky combination. So Franco spent half a day lining up in front of a San Francisco Apple store to get his drawn notebook fixed. And when he eventually arrived at the restaurant, he was somewhat unnerved by all those people who couldn't live a single day without having the brand new device in their hands. I attribute to this little episode a kind of allegorical meaning, since I have experienced Franco Moretti as somebody who keeps his distance from any kind of techie fetishism. And this also applies to the field of study of which he is a pioneer, digital humanities. In the restaurant where we met, Franco told me that he sometimes felt himself surrounded by people who are great in their sophisticated use of software but don't know how to read anymore. To carefully read literary texts instead of just letting the computer check them through. He said that with a kind of melancholy that one wouldn't have expected from somebody who has so forcefully introduced digitization into literary studies. But in his writings as well, he often adds a skeptical twist to his demanding and for many scholars in the field provocative agenda. Think of his groundbreaking essay, Conjectures of World Literature, where he develops the concept of distant reading, which is by itself a somewhat ironic reaction to the kind of close reading introduced by the proponents of new criticism after World War II. In this essay, Franco Moretti encourages us to engage in a little pact with the devil by adopting quantitative methods of literary analysis. He calls it computational criticism instead of traditional hermeneutical ones. What is that, a literary historian who takes over the role of Goethe's Mephistopheles? And who would embody the part of Faust? What is at the core of the famously coined program of distant reading? Its starting point is an experience all of us, particularly the literary historians among us, share, the experience of the endlessness of reading material. With respect to literature, things get even worse once we take into account the fact that we can't continue to behave as if we still lived in the age of nation states and national cultures kept apart from each other. I quote from Franco's article. After all, the literature around us is now unmistakably a planetary system. The question is not really what we should do, the question is how. What does it mean studying world literature? How do we do it? I worked on West European narratives between 1790 and 1930 and already feel like a charlatan outside of Britain or France. World literature? Many people have read more and better than I have, of course, but still we are talking of hundreds of languages and literatures here. Reading more seems hardly to be the solution, especially because we have just started rediscovering what Margaret Cohen calls the great unread. I work on West European narrative, etc. Not really. I work on its canonical fraction, which is not even 1% of published literature. And again, some people have read more, but the point is that there are 30,000 19th century British novels out there, 40, 50, 60,000. No one really knows, no one has read them, no one ever will. And then there are French novels, Chinese, Argentinian, American. Reading more is always a good thing, but not the solution. So what do we do instead if we consider that we have only one life and not the many available to us in computer games? Should we still stick to the virtues of a close and scrupulous reading, word by word, phrase by phrase, day and night? No, says Franco Moretti, and here comes our relief. The trouble with close reading, in all of its incarnations, from the new criticism to deconstruction, is that it necessarily depends on an extremely small canon. This may have become an unconscious and invisible premise by now, but it is an iron one nonetheless. You invest so much in individual texts only if you think that very few of them really matter. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. And if you want to look beyond the canon, and of course world literature will do so, it would be absurd if it didn't, close reading will not do it. It's not designed to do it, it's designed to do the opposite. At bottom, it's a theological exercise, very solemn treatment of few texts taken very seriously, whereas what we really need is a little pact with the devil. We know how to read texts, now let's learn how not to read them. Distance reading, where distance, let me repeat it, is a condition of knowledge. It allows you to focus on units that are much smaller and much larger than the text, devices, themes, tropes, or genres and systems. And if between the very small and the very large, the text itself appears well, it's one of those cases when one can justifiably say less is more. There's a rising wave of literary people who open their minds to Franco Moretti's Mephistophelian advice and try to figure out the fine print conditions of that wager. Conjectures of World Literature, which came out with New Left Review in January 2000 at the very beginning of this millennium, is the kind of article every one of us would love to have written, at least with respect to its overwhelming international resonance. But Franco Moretti's book, too, are widely read, to clarify, read by human beings, and translated into several languages. To my knowledge, his earliest publication, his earliest publication is Science Taken for Oneness, Essays in the Sociology of Literary Forms from 1983, which already documents a specific interest in problems of genre and literary form, as well as their relationship with social formations. This book, as well as the following monograph, The Way of the World, the Bildungsroman in European Culture, published in 2000, are insightful studies in a more classical sense. The Way of the World deals with a topic that forms the center of Franco's expertise, namely the 19th century European novel. Graphs, Maps and Trees, 2005, is much more provocative. The book aims at introducing mathematical, i.e. in a stricter sense, scientific methods into a, what he calls, tired disciplinary field that Moretti in the New York Times famously stigmatized as one of, I quote, the most backward disciplines in the academy, end quote. Among those methods is network analysis, one of the hottest topics of our days. The Bourgeois Between History and Literature, 2013, takes again different path as it combines formal party grammatical analysis with an approach that one might call deep social hermeneutics. Franco's last publication, Distant Reading, is a collection of essays demonstrating the potential of quantitative literary analysis, and I'm proud to announce that the German translation of this book will appear with Konstanz University Press next year. So what would Wolfgang Iser have thought of the program of distant reading? I'm quite sure that he was open-minded and curious enough to attend this lecture, the seventh lecture in honor of him here in Konstanz, where he lived for 25 years from 1966 until 1998. Is distant reading compatible with Isa's reception theory? Can the implied reader, in the way Isa made use of Wayne Booth's term, get automatized? Can it be a software program instead of a personal receiver? After all, this implied reader is not a human being in flesh and blood, but the author's more shadowy image of it, or more precisely, a bunch of indexes in the text which outline the author's expectations, or that of the text itself, of how to be read. Maybe those signs can be deciphered algorithmically so that the respective text processing software could emulate an image of this image. However, there will remain a decisive difference. The basic assumption of reception theory is that the texts are incomplete without being read, because they are not self-sufficient, but part of an ongoing process of communication. This guiding idea can be traced back to the era of old European rhetoric, when literary exchange was modeled on the idea of a face-to-face conversation as a substitute or continuation of an ongoing personal dialogue. The program of distant reading, it seems to me, dispenses the illusion of an engaged, yet even say heated conversation between spirits crossing space and time. It's a much more formal, objectifying, as it were, cooler strategy for looking at masses of texts, for example, forgotten Victorian novels, which don't necessarily speak to us. In this respect, it sides with traditions of formalism and structuralism in the 20th century. One could even say that it represents the last stage of a process in the course of which literature was increasingly de-rhetoricized. What is characteristic for Franco Moretti's writings, however, is the fact that his personal style gives a completely different impression. Very personal, tentative, essayistic, and in many respects also politically highly engaged. And last but not least, rooted in a philological ethos in its deepest sense, a love of literature. Thank you for being here, Franco. We look forward to your presentation.
Thank you for inviting me here, Albrecht, and for this introduction. I either was an author I learned to know late in my education. I learned a lot, however, once I started reading him. It certainly was perhaps the most important influence in making me understand how Joyce's stream of consciousness works, which is no little feat for any critic. And I myself have wondered what would he have thought about this, and I think you're right. He would have been, I like to think that he would have been curious enough to sit here. I suspect your characterization of the two methodologies is absolutely right. This is a very objectifying, in a sense, it's one more stage in the formalist structuralist lineage made possible by digitization. Anyway, you will be the judges of this. I'm very happy to be here. And what I'm presenting today, as most things that are the result of the work we do at this literary lab that I've started at Stanford, is a collective work. Mark L. G. Hewitt is a junior young colleague who's been hired at Stanford a year ago. Ryan Heuser is a graduate student. They are both capable of programming, which I am not. So there is an element of a division of labor in group work. There is more than that, and maybe I'll come to that. One final point, I will present a lot of charts. I will go fast through some of them because they're peripheral examples. We are, again, used at that thing we call, with a certain euphoria, literary lab. We are used to interruptions when we speak, so if something is not clear and if you want me to be clearer about it, just raise your hand. I'll stop and sort of explain. But of course, bigger questions for later. And let me explain what lies behind this idea here. It's perhaps the first image will give you a sense. This is the last chart in a book in Digital Humanities, Macroanalysis by Matt Jockers. This is composed of about 3,000 nodes. There are 3,000 dots here. Each of them is a 19th century English novel. There are 165,000 connections between them, based on 600 features of similarity and dissimilarity. And you cannot see the dots. You can't really even see the 165,000 threads unless they're... But there's so many of them that all these very tiny units end up adding up to this very large cloud. And there's a lot of an unusual amount of information here. But this conjunction of the very small that adds up to the very large has become typical of digital humanities or computational criticism, however one wants to call it. And see, look at this. This is a group of Stanford grad students. And they have, you know, this is what they call a diagram of metricality, basically thousands of English poems from several centuries, two sets of variables, whether the rhythm is rising or falling, whether the feat is two or three parts, and, you know, two sets of variables, and, you know, centuries of poetry can be mapped onto a single diagram. Or last of these early instances, this is something Mark Algie Hewitt did. This is a chart of 19th century novels, of a corpus of a few thousand 19th century novels, based on bigrams. Bigrams are two consecutive words in a text. A 19th century novel, usually 200,000 words. It has 200,000 bigrams because you count them all. And on the basis of their repetition, he's created this chart of information and redundancy in 19th century novels. And he's actually discovered this pretty striking separation between canonical novels and indeed the great unread. This is part of another study we are doing. And, you know, I had like 15 such examples. The units change, the form of visualization changes, but this leap from the very small to the very large remains constant. It's really become the signature of the digital humanities and its approach to literature. And it's an approach that quite clearly focuses on the extremes of the literary scale, small and large. And in this, it's a dramatic break with the tradition of literary criticism, which has always focused on a middle scale, on a scene, an episode, a stanza, an excerpt, a text, a scale which is fundamentally an anthropocentric one, where readers are the measure of things. Here, readers are nothing. So the question is, what does the study of literature become in this new situation? This is what I'm trying to address here and in the seminar tomorrow morning. And one option consists in simply sticking with only the very small and the very large. And this is not something that digital humanities has invented, because by and large, this was Spitzer's choice in his development of stylistics. Spitzer, in all his major essays, always focuses on two units, the detail and the whole. He got them from hermeneutics, of course, and the analysis is this constant process of leaps from detail to whole, a series of back and forth movements. This is from linguistics and literary history. First a detail, then the whole, then another detail, etc., until the characteristic click occurs, which is the indication that detail and whole have found a common denominator. Detail and whole, the very small and the very large, and only detail and whole. It's, you know, word deformation in Don Quixote and the novel and the ideology of the novel as such. The use of conjunctions in poetry and the universe of French symbolist poetry as such. Neologisms and Rabelais' oeuvre as a whole. It's always this, from one extreme to another. At its most perfect, Spitzer again, the solution attained by means of the circular operation is a negation of steps. Once attained, it tends to obliterate the steps leading up to it. One may think here of the lion of medieval bestiaries. The lion of medieval bestiaries would probably bear a Latin name, and the Latin name would, of course, be Leo, like Spitzer's. The lion of medieval bestiaries who at every step forward wiped out his footprints with his tail in order to elude his pursuers. This is a lovely simile, of course. Well, our aim here in this specific project is exactly the opposite of Spitzer's, not obliterating the intermediate steps, but making them explicit and solid, finding a new middle scale typical of digital humanities. And the idea is that this new middle scale would be that of the paragraph. This would be a talk on paragraphs, basically. Paragraphs are, we all write in paragraphs. We all obsess about paragraphs. Should it end? Should I begin a new one? Et cetera, et cetera. We don't really know how they work. Unlike sentences, which have been thoroughly studied, unlike chapters, which have been studied less, but still have been studied, paragraphs have remained a sort of under-examined unit, articulation of prose writing. And so as we moved to this study, the initial idea was to work to build on a previous work we had done on literary scale. It was an essay entitled Style at the Scale of the Sentence, in which we had the idea that the specific scale of the sentence is where, is the scale, is the level of the text, where the phenomenon of style becomes recognizable. Below, it's unrecognizable. Above the sentence, it already exists. It comes into being at the scale of the sentence. So since, you know, we're narcissistically rather happy with the results we had found, we figured, okay, we will study style at the scale of the paragraph, see what changes when one moves up one level. A paragraph, usually in 19th century literature, on which we tend to work quite often, is made of, on average, 4 or 5 sentences. So it seemed to be, just the immediate next scale. And it's not just that, it's that in the United States, the most famous essay of American stylistics is an essay by Ian Watt entitled On the First Paragraph of Henry James, the Ambassadors. And it is analysis of that paragraph indeed. And as you may know, when Auerbach first had an idea of mimesis, of the book that would become mimesis, was 10 years earlier, it was in Istanbul. He published an essay entitled Über die Ernste Nachahmung des Alltäglichen. And the essay begins with a paragraph by Flaubert. And then Auerbach's writing begins, and the first sentence is, dieser Absatz steht im 9. Kapitel des ersten, dieser Absatz. Mimesis is taking shape, and the first, this was published in Istanbul in a small journal of the Travaux de Séminaire, of the Séminaire de Philologie Romane. The first word that comes to Auerbach's mind when he's beginning to think of the book is paragraph. So it seemed that style at the scale of the paragraph was a plausible idea. Then you reread Auerbach, indeed, and Watt, and there's clearly something odd in how they deal with paragraphs, because they do study style at that scale, one paragraph in James, one in Balzac, one in Flaubert, in Mimesis, a few more for Stendhal and Zola, but the paragraph as such never is actually addressed, neither by Watt nor by Auerbach. And paragraphs contain style. They're boxes in which style exists, but don't shape it. it's telling that Watt, in his essay, refers to that piece of the ambassadors three times as a paragraph, but 13 times as a passage. And rightly so, because he's not really thinking of a paragraph. He's thinking of a passage. The form of the paragraph doesn't exist, really, in his reason. So at first we thought, okay, we'll improve on this, but actually after a few inconclusive attempts, we realized that Watt and Auerbach had been right in deciding that a stylistics of the paragraph was probably not doable. So if paragraphs are an important articulation of prose writing, and we were still thinking that, we still thought that they deserve to be studied, they could not be studied via style, but then via what? What is it that gives paragraphs their unity? You read the chapters in Auerbach's Mimesis on French realist novelists, and whenever he is trying to address obliquely what their paragraphs do, he uses two main cognitive metaphors. One is pictorial. A paragraph is a scene, a portrait, a picture, the realism so well known from the Flemish and especially the Dutch painting, a literary portrait, and so on. The second cognitive metaphor is musical. What we have in a paragraph is description is controlled by a leading motif, which is several times leitmotif, which is several times repeated. The first words of the paragraph state that theme, and all that follows is but a development, a resumption, a variation of the principal theme, and so on. So scene, portrait, picture, motif, theme. Clearly, for Auerbach, paragraphs are not stylistic units, but thematic ones, which, after all, more or less is also the common sense idea of the paragraph. A paragraph should have a point, should center about an idea. Okay. So we decided to take this, not a stylistics of the paragraph, but a thematics of the paragraph. And thematic study in digital humanities, as many of you may know, means topic modeling. Topic modeling, let me explain very quickly. Topic modeling is basically it's a program that can, you can create a corpus, a text, a million texts, whatever. You give it to the program, to the topic model, and ask the program to find the 50 main topics or 100 or 500 main topics in the corpus. And the program reads and reads and reads and reads the corpus and basically establishes these topics on the basis of words that tend to occur close together. Its topics are based on co-occurrence. We've never used topic modeling at the lab because there are many, many questionable issues about it, and I will probably present a couple of them. Indeed, my skeptical note that Albrecht was mentioning in the. But it also seemed an interesting moment to address that. And incidentally, I have made a slip here, as you may have noticed. I was talking about thematics, and then I moved to topic modeling. As far as I know, there has never been a serious discussion between topic modeling and thematics. And this is typical, alas, of the state of digital humanities. Many of its techniques, many of its approaches have a conceptual relationship to pre-existing literary theories, but by and large, to make explicit this relationship, to address, to change, to challenge, to destroy, or to accept the pre-existing concept, that's not something that people who work in digital humanities usually do. We tend to do it, in part because, I've devoted so much of my life to studying that literary theory, it seems crazy not to address it. But so, in part, this is, I'll keep it at the periphery, it's a meditation on what is the relationship between these new way of looking at themes and the old way of looking at themes. The old way of looking at themes, mind you, was far from perfect. In fact, even in the recent renaissance of thematic criticism, recent, the last decade or two of the 20th century. The people involved in it, Pavel, Bremond, Solers, Segre, and company, they all acknowledged that there is a fundamental vagueness about the central concepts, themes, motifs, etc. The main, what I will assume, and you know, the general consensus is just to be on the same page, so to speak, in terms of the terms used. A theme is usually large, abstract, more of a concept than a real presence in the text. Motif is small, local, and actually objectively there in the text. And what we're trying to do with this study is say, okay, paragraphs are not exactly in the middle between these two things, but they provide like a third position to reopen the discussion between theme and motive and thematics as a whole. All right. And we had a hypothesis which was rather simple and fortunately easy to test. If paragraphs are indeed dominated, if the unity of a paragraph is established by its thematic consistency, then paragraphs should correlate particularly well with the topics that topic modeling extracts from corpora. And the reason this is important is that topic modeling works in the way I described, but I didn't mention one aspect of the operation, which is this. Topic modeling first segments, the program segments the corpus, the text, whatever, in, let's call them mechanical slices, usually 1,000 words. You have to figure out words co-occurring together, but you can't every time look at tens of millions of words. So, you know, it operates on a scale of 1,000 words. Now, if paragraphs are thematic units, then they should correlate with topics better than the unit usually used by topic models. So this was the idea. We began by calculating the length of paragraphs. There is always a lot of tedious. I mean, in order, you have an idea, there are the algorithms, the methods, but in order to actually, as the jargon has it, operationalize the idea, i.e. turn it into a series of operations that a machine can perform, you have to go through a lot of steps. So first of all, we had to calculate the average length of the paragraphs. There were additional problems. I can go back to all of these things in the question period. It turned out that the average length of narrative paragraphs, because of course there are paragraphs of dialogue that are very short, whereas that. So in the end, we decided to only look at narrative paragraphs. Incidentally, Auerbach and Watt almost always look only at narrative paragraphs. So this was not a crazy decision. It was in the tradition of looking at paragraphs. The average length was 82 words, and so we created three groups: the paragraphs in the corpus, the mechanical slices, 82 words in length, and mechanical slices, 200 words in length, and looked at which of the three had a greater thematic focus, as we said, and much to our paragraphs are in blue. These are 82 word slices. These are 200 word slices. These are called at times box and whisker plots. These two boxes, this is the median. These two boxes are the 25% above and below the median, and the whiskers are the other 25% above and below. And as you can see, paragraphs score much higher, I will explain what that means, score much higher than 82-word slices and 200-word slices in this. What does thematic focus mean? How did we measure that? Again, this is a matter of operationalizing, right? I mean, you have an idea, but how do you turn it into numbers? much of the pathos of this, it's not a great pathos, but, you know, whatever, the intellectual pathos is in trying to translate words into operations, into... there is no literary concept for concentration or focus. There is no literary measure, but there are measures in economics, and so we use two measures used in the discipline of economics. One is the Gini coefficient, which studies, it has been quite a lot in the public sphere in recent years. It measures inequality, and we applied the Gini coefficient to the many topics in our corpus. And so the more a paragraph had a high Gini coefficient, so a high inequality, the more a single topic was dominating the paragraph. The second is another measure. It's called the Herfindahl measure, and it's basically a measure of market concentration. Think of a paragraph as a bag of words, 82 words, limited space, and topics as firms that try to occupy this market, and Herfindahl measure measures, you know, the level of market concentration. And so we use these two economic measures to figure out the results that I've shown here. Now, what does this result mean? First of all, just to be clear, we did not discover that paragraphs were thematic units. This was something that was known. All of us have learned this fact in elementary school in one way or another and have used it since. So it's a well-known fact. The point is, not all well-known facts are also true, and having proved that this is true is a little accomplishment. Corroboration is not very important in the humanities, but perhaps it should be a little more important than the nothing that it is right now. So the first task was one, accomplishment, was one of corroborating a certain idea. More significantly, if this is correct, then it follows that people who do topic modeling, and there are a lot of people in the digital humanities who use topic modeling, are mistaken when they use 200-word slices or even longer slices. Their unit of research should be the paragraph. It is much more reliable if you want to study topics to use paragraphs than to use abstract slices. So this was just a little more important in terms of changing the way a part of digital humanities works. And really something similar can be said about thematics. If someone is interested in a thematic approach to literature, then the paragraph should loom very large in the research, whereas it doesn't. I've never been there. I've had a formalist, a Marxist formalist formation, like many people in the 60s and 70s, or some people at least. And so thematics for me was always, this is in the real world, this is not really the literary specificity, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, I have done my thematic homework in recent months and read much of this, actually, very interesting work, of course, by major thinkers like Ni Pavel, Bremond, Segre, et cetera, et cetera. Paragraphs basically never appear. They should, because that's where themes show up. Where are themes in a text? No one really knows. But a paragraph is a good starting point to rethink the whole problem. But in order to do this, to see how paragraphs work with themes, we now have to look more in detail at a few of these paragraphs. And here is, right, so far, it's not even a word has appeared, just numbers, diagrams, et cetera, et cetera. Now we turn to words and to a certain extent, even to very attentive reading of certain passages. That's good, that's fine, reading passages. There is still, I think, an important difference between the readings that I will do in the next 20 minutes or so and what usually is called close reading. Close reading, other forms of interpretive active engagement with the text, assume the text as a starting point and make sense within this assumption. What I will do assumes as a starting point not a text but a series. Like, for instance, I will begin with a series of paragraphs of a certain type from different novels. So you read the words, the sentences, the paragraphs very attentively, but it's a reading that is part of a different set than what close reading usually does. Okay, let's look at this. This is what one of our paragraphs in our study does. This is a paragraph from Middlemarch. And here, these colors, the colors that appear in the words, are the words that the topic model, that the program, assigns to a given topic. And there is this topic zero, the purple topic, which occupies more than half of the available space of the paragraph. There is a lot of technical stuff that goes into these scores, and take my word for it. We can go into the details in the question period. But now, for practical purposes, believe me. And so there is this one topic. This was the first, if paragraphs are about themes and have a much higher level of focus, of concentration on themes than other textual segments, well then, our first and almost obvious next step was to look at those paragraphs which focused very, very much on a single theme. And so where these scores would be 60, 70%, over 50% of the paragraph would be occupied by a single topic. And just to make it more readable, here is the topic. The bolded words are part of the main topic. This is a topic that could be called something like self-definition. It's an act of self-definition. Personal independence, personal expectations, etc., etc. But here you can immediately see one reason why we are often skeptical about topics. Is this a single theme? Or is it at least two themes in which one, liberality, personal independence, personal expectations, expectations again, maybe motives and considerations, has to do with indeed how, this is a Bildungsroman, how a young person defines himself in the world. But the other one, suppose, prove, reason, imagine, this is really a sort of hermeneutic semantic cluster. And the two don't really have a significant relationship between them. So problem one with topics, they are often inconsistent. The same box contains words that do not seem to belong to the same semantic universe. We don't think this can be corrected. Again, there is a lot of technical literature about it. We don't think this is can be correct. Yes? Good point. So all you can do with topic modeling is ask the program to give you the 10 main topics or the 50 main topics or the 100 main topics, and then the program gives them to you. It doesn't give labels. It just gives you enormously long lists of words. So, yeah, they and all of these are all in the same box. But you look at them and say, well, shouldn't there be two boxes here? And of course, if there should be two boxes, then what are we doing? I mean, what is the validity of a single topic? Still, I'll try to see what one can do with this problem, but I don't think it can be eliminated. First type, we call these monothematic or monotopical paragraphs, extremely concentrated. Let me go a little faster. There's a second type. There's a second type which has to do with the creation of suspense. And all at once, quick rang the bell, quick but not loud, a cautious tinkle, a sort of warning, metal whisper. Rosine darted from her cabinet and ran to open. The person she admitted stood with her 2 minutes in parley. There seemed to be a demur. This is, you know, a moment of, you know, what is going on? Who is this person? Here too, incidentally, there are at least two semantic clusters. One has to do with the house, cabinet, garden, door, maybe lamp, steps, etc. One has to do with sound, rang, loud, cautious, tinkle, whisper, etc. Again, they in theory belong to the same topic. In practice, it's hard to see. But this seemed to be a second function that repeats itself in these monothematic paragraphs. It makes sense. A concentration that creates narrative suspense. And the third type, similar but not identical to suspense, it's a narrative turning point. This is the prelude to one of the most famous confessions of infanticide in English literature. And, you know, slowly, while she was speaking, step forward, they move apart, and then the confession will follow. So just to summarize, we were looking for thematic focus. We looked at the most focused of paragraphs, those where a single topic dominated the paragraph, and found self-definition, suspense, and turning points. We found, in other words, three aspects of what Weyrich in Tempus called the narrative foreground. And this is the memorable aspects of a novel. And this in itself is an interesting aspect, I think. We were not looking for narrative categories. We were looking for thematic ones. But the first thematic category to which we devoted our attention was much more involved with the narrative structure, with one aspect of the narrative structure of a novel than we expected. However, okay, paragraphs are about making a point, and very focused paragraphs make so very forceful, but that doesn't mean that this type of monothematic paragraphs is all the paragraphs we have. In fact, this is the middle of the floss, and the dark blue is paragraphs dominated by a single topic, two topics, three topics, four topics, five, six or more. As you can see, the paragraphs I have presented so far are a really small minority of a text. It may well be what paragraphs do at their best. They may be the most memorable paragraphs of a book, but they're not the most frequent. And, you know, different novels have different results. This is Phineas Finn, and in this case, actually, there are a lot of paragraphs with several topics. And so in our second step, having studied this, we didn't know that there were so few monothematic paragraphs. I mean, we had gone there by the logic of concept. Then it occurred to us, well, how many of these actually are there? And then we realized, and so we said, okay, let's go to the opposite end of the spectrum, and we started studying this type of paragraph, the one in which, you know, the paragraph is still about conveying themes, but not one theme, several themes. And how does that work? And this is how it works. As you can see, it's a sort of harlequin dress of different topic, different colors. Each topic has a color. And here, you know, almost every other four or five words, a different topic enters the paragraph, as opposed to the much more monotonous color scheme of the previous talk. It's difficult to go backwards. So let me say that the previous paragraph, instead of having suspense focuses on a single aspect of a text. think of, you know, the man who knew too much and symbols that have to be struck at a certain point and how often Hitchcock shows them. Suspense focuses on a single topic. What we have in these polytopical paragraphs is not a surprise. A lot of things happen. That's why there are so many themes. Because, you know, there, as in the previous paragraphs or in this one, here it's not just that a lot of things happen, a lot of characters appear in the paragraph. This is another paragraph from Middlemarch, but instead of having like that single personal self-presentation that we saw in the previous paragraph, there are 9 different characters mentioned in 100 words. So, whereas monothematic paragraphs focused on the on suspense, polythematic ones focus on surprise, which is a much more lighthearted form of narrative development. Monothematic paragraphs tend to focus on the protagonists of the story. Polythematic paragraphs focus on minor characters, or they may even include one of the main characters, but there is so little space for each of the characters in the paragraph that everybody becomes a minor character, so to speak. And so this also means, as in this case indeed, that the paragraph inclines towards inevitably caricature or irony or comment. Oh. And I think you can see it if I can. Yes. You know, it's whereas monothematic paragraphs tended to be extremely serious, often even desperate, polythematic ones seem to be. And so you have the beginning of a whole spectrum. Paragraphs can really operate on the on a very large gamut of thematic and narrative possibilities. But again, we looked at one extreme of the scale and at the other extreme of the scale. And when you start, this is something I've realized, when you start working on quantitative data, you have these huge distributions, and there is for me, always the temptation to run to extreme results, because extreme results usually are always striking in one way or another. Because basically they tell you when a system begins to work and when the system sort of almost stops working. Like here, for instance, what happens in, remember what I said at the beginning. Why were we interested in the paragraph? Because we wanted to study another scale higher than that of the sentence. And in the monothematic paragraphs, the ones with which I began, you can really, I didn't say that, but I hope you perceived that there was really like a higher scale. It was like the paragraph was in some ways almost embodying the text as a whole. When Will Ladislaw in Middlemarch says the things he says, that's really, that could be an exemplary page for that 1,000-page long novel. Here, in passages like this, the paragraph almost decomposes in its constituent sentences. It's as if that higher scale is no longer actually working. But again, you look at the extremes of the scale, they're interesting, but they're not the whole story. In fact, this, you know, as I said, the trouble with having two programmers is that one works from left to right and the other works from right to left, and they change colors. And these are monothematic paragraphs. These are paragraphs that have 6 or more topics, but actually the majority of paragraphs lies in the middle. And in fact, paragraphs with 3 main topics, paragraphs where 3 topics add up to over 50% of the semantic space, they are more frequent than the combination of the 2 extremes of the scale together. So, next step in our process we turn to these mid-type paragraphs, and this will be the last analytical point I'll make. There could be others, but you know, then I'll draw the conclusions, and we can go into the discussion. So we looked at the paragraphs here in the middle, and it's always that's the hardest. Again, when you start studying quantitative results, the extremes of the scale are relatively easy to deal with. The average is very hard. It's the hardest part of the job. But I think that is really where the challenge lies, because after all, you know, quantitative work almost by definition will give average results a much greater presence than they usually have, and we have to learn to make sense of that. The average is often what goes without saying, what remains unperceived. Quantitative work forces you to look at it because it says, look, this is what is there most of the time. This is one of those paragraphs. This is from David Copperfield. And I've highlighted the three main topics. One has to do more or less with feelings and expectations, influence, feel, uneasiness, shadow, doubts, fears. The second, in blue, has to do with the house in which he finds himself, house, knocks, room, staircase. The third is kind of in green, is kind of vaguer, and it may have to do with the passing of time, began, softening, grave, past. Another problem with topics, before one of you notices it, I'll tell you, look at how crazy it is that books belongs to red topic, but also belongs to the blue topic, and then there is school books somewhere, or school. Yeah, and belongs to the third one. And, you know, the point is that just about most frequent words belong to more than one topic, but again, inconsistency in assigned in there. Why should books be assigned once to one topic and once to another one? The program doesn't tell you, it just does it. And clearly it's not, you know, it makes, one would like to have more solid ground. But anyway, what even with these inconsistencies and problems, there seem to be these three topics of which at least two are reasonably clear. This is from John Halifax, Gentleman, which was a very great success in the mid-19th century. And here also we have three main topics. One has to do with something like, you know, family, mother, boy, petted boy. One has to do with sort of reflection and expectations, wisest, safest, expected, kindness, consent. And the third one in green, again, has to do with something maybe like, you know, ideas about general human nature, but who knows, instinct, accustomed, children. But again, it's not that. In both cases, both this and the David Copperfield paragraph I showed earlier, there seemed, however, to be something very different from the other cases I presented earlier. What seems to happen here is that instead of a focus on the foreground and on protagonist, or on minor characters and the narrator's comment, what is happening here is what we could call the physiology of narrative. These are paragraphs in which nothing major happens. And these are indeed the paragraphs that provide our usual horizon of expectation when we read a novel. In most paragraphs, we expect something like this. Something is happening, but nothing which needs to have a reaction of, you know, concentration on suspense or dismissal because of irony and caricature, etc., etc. And when we think of narrative movement, it's as if, you know, this is neither foreground nor background, really. It's something like the flow of narrative, the ordinary, physiological, indeed, flow of narrative. And this is one aspect of the conclusions I would like to draw. What seems to be suggested by, especially by these type of paragraphs, and also in conjunction with the previous two, is that when we think of narrative, we of the logic of narrative, of plot, and so on, we tend to think in terms of actions and transformations, which is right, of course, but perhaps it should be coordinated with thematics. Much of what allows a narrative to move on is this capacity to combine two or three topics together in these most frequent of paragraphs. In this respect, it is similar to Propp's idea of function in the morphology of the folktale with a new twist, however. It's similar because Propp also, in the morphology of the folktale, was trying, with the concept of function for him, was a concept that combined an action with a theme. And in fact, he himself says so at a certain point, which I hope to find now, in his definition. Well, I will find it, but, you know, this is... See, this is what I'm working with, so it's not easy to recover it. But I will, in the fullness of time, I'm sure I will find it. Anyway, a function by Propp usually unites, indeed, an action, but an action which is related to a theme like, you know, parental presence or villainy and so on. The difference here is that it's not a single theme that is part of the paragraph, but it's a combination of more than one. How exactly should this be developed? I still don't know. Final point, scale. So this is, you know, titled Micromégas, inspired by Voltaire's philosophical Kant. I began by talking about sentences, from sentences to paragraphs, and one can even think beyond paragraphs. If sentences are where style emerges and paragraphs is where themes find their exemplification, then chapters is probably where the larger units of plot emerge, episodes. The interesting thing is that at different scales, texts seem to specialize in different tasks. As you change scale, you also change what is mostly going on, mostly. Because, of course, its paragraphs are made of sentences and chapters are made of paragraphs. If sentences is where style emerges, well, there will be style also in paragraphs because a sentence is part of a paragraph. There will be. It's just not going to be the salient feature of that scale. There will be themes at the level of the chapter. It's just that it will not be the most important aspect of a chapter. Just like there is narrative at the level of the paragraph, but maybe it doesn't have the same relevance for the plot that it achieves at the level of the chapter. Second point about scale. The first time we looked at this concept, as I said, we were trying to figure out when can we start to talk about style. Single words? No. Prepositional phrases? I remember I had found the typical Gothic novel title, The X of Y, The Castle of Otranto, The Mines of Golitska. Is this style? Not really. A student of mine had found a tick in Edgar Allan Poe which he called the X of Y of Z, the fall of the house of Usher, which he uses, Poe uses this triple prepositional phrases extremely often. Is this style? Maybe, maybe not. I mean, clearly we were getting close. And then once we started looking at sentences, again, another of our grad students had done work on a specific sentence by Eliot, we realized, okay, this is where style really emerges. And inevitably, we understood scale, higher scale, as an increase in the complexity of what the text was doing. Because indeed, style vis-a-vis prepositional phrases is unquestionably an increase in complexity. But when you move from style at the scale of the sentence to themes at the scale of the paragraph, to episodes at the scale of the paragraph, of the chapter, there isn't really an increase in complexity. Themes are not more complex than style. Episodes are not more complex than either. So there is a functional differentiation. The increase in complexity does not consist in the specific task accomplished at a given scale. It consists in the fact that more than one scale is interacting at this point. So it's a different principle of operation. All right. More things. This is about half of the talk I could have presented here, but I've talked already for much too long, so I will stop here, and I'll be happy to have questions or objections or whatever. Thank you very much. So the first question, you're totally right. I mean, not only the last chapter of Ulysses is a single or a paragraph or a few paragraphs and so on and so on. And paragraphs even earlier, you know, they haven't always existed. They have a very fragmented story, and certainly in the 18th century novels, they're much longer than... It would be interesting to have a historical study of the emergence of the structure. We actually were trying to do a morphological study, rather a functional study, rather than a historical one. So we picked 20 texts, all from the mid-19th century, all from the same genre, so that, you know, all other variables would be eliminated, and we would look at a sort of an ideal type of the paragraph. Now, maybe English Bildungsromane of the mid-Victorian age are not the right pool for that, in which case the morphology of the paragraph with which we have come up will prove to be wrong. But, you know, the point is there is really extremely little theoretical work on the paragraph. So one has to start somewhere. We started there. But, you know, but this is a limit. I don't think I mentioned the corpus we were working on. It's important. I think it would be very interesting if the paragraph is indeed an important scale which does a specific work that no other scale, and I'll return to the second question, does. It would be very interesting to figure out when the selective pressure started to be activated that actually forced the paragraph to emerge. See what I mean? But this is a very interesting historical question, not for this type of... I know it's difficult to go back to those measurements. We were delighted with what we found because, you know, the other segments, the other types of textual segments, three quarters of them were below three quarters of the paragraphs, et cetera, et cetera. In terms of values, the difference may have been small, but in terms of their comparison was actually pretty strong. And remember, the usual segment used by topic modeling is not 200, it's 1,000 words. We should have been even more distant. We were trying to make it hard for us to get a good result. As for sentences, this is a good question. Why not measure thematics at the level of the sentence and thematic concentration at the level of the sentence, right? Because after all, many sentences have enormous thematic focus. Mehr Licht. I would prefer not to. Reader, I married him. I mean, it's, you know, it's not... And that's precisely the problem. Sentences, being short, are almost inevitably extremely concentrated thematically. But, you know, they're concentrated with few words, whereas what it seems to us that what you need is a unit large enough that it may not be thematically focused. And then the fact that it is becomes significant. A sentence can only be thematically focused. So you can, so as a finding, it's not interesting, but it's always a thematic focus, which is, well, to speak the language of thematics, etc., has to do perhaps more with a motif than with a theme, with a motif that is to say, with a very small local reader, I married him, mehr Licht, you know, just not enlightenment, which would be the theme, or, you know, marriage, but just I married him. I don't know how to program, but I know how to discuss what I would like from a program, what a program can and cannot do, and given the limitations of existing programs, and what are the consequences for the type of analysis that I can do. So it's not a fact of being capable of using the tool, but of understanding how the use of the tool can contribute to the broader argument. At least for me, that's how I deal with that question. That said, I've noticed, especially in both of these younger colleagues, for instance, that by not knowing how to program, I am actually losing something, because there is a programming intelligence. There are ideas that arise from the fact that one can play with a program, and that I will never have. Because for me, I have to have my ideas and ask a program to execute them. Or a program does something and I have to figure out what's happened. In their case, there is a much greater flexibility in which the question, the possibility, you know, just as in every technique that you can use. I mean, so in that respect, there is a new generation of younger people who will probably have a much more creative relationship with literary theory than what has happened so far, because they will be capable of both programming and thinking in literary theoretical terms. I'm not so sure that one would need one can do different things, say, from if you study novels and if you study plays, because the structure is very different. You study 20th century novels, probably Finnegan's Wake and Perec and Queneau would be outliers in any distribution, but there would be a very large distribution that one can study just the same. So I don't. That's not something that worries me. The reason why we can't study the 20th century is copyright. It has nothing to do with knowledge. It has everything to do with money. I mean, it's a nightmare trying to study the 20th century. Otherwise, you know, this would be an ideal. So 20th century has that problem. 18th century has the problem that the printing is still very erratic and the computer makes a lot of mistakes in reading it. So the 19th century has become very important by default, because earlier stages, medieval novels come in so many different texts, etc. They require different approaches of more of a philological kind, but there are people who actually do that. I don't know. I think, you know, this is the beginning of the work. And there are so many methods that can be used. I only use topic modeling here, but which, again, was the first time we used. As for the other thing, I encountered, I don't think it was German, it was from Central Europe, but I think from Eastern Central Europe, quantitative stylistics from the 60s, 70s, 80s, some studies that were conceptually very strong, but, you know, the archives were much smaller, the algorithms were much weaker, so, you know, that's... we are really dwarfs on the shoulders of giants. I mean, we have archives that Spitzer would have killed for the kind of stuff we have, both in terms of data and in terms of analytical techniques. So I've never gone back to that, even though, as you can see, I discussed Spitzer today an hour back in a later part of this. It's Tomaszewski and others. So I always try to think in terms of the literary tradition, the tradition of literary theory. This aspect has never, also in part because attribution studies I've never been interested in. And much of early work was indeed the Federalist Papers, all these, the Book of Mormon, who really wrote it, angels, not angels, etc. And you also asked something else, but now I've forgotten the final.
Results you never asked for.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, look, we wanted to study style. We ended up studying themes, which is something none of us had ever. So this was something. And then with themes, we didn't expect paragraphs to have this spectrum of variation. We didn't expect, and we're still working and trying to figure out what the relationship between themes and narrative is. And in fact, if I can just show, you see, at a certain point we said, okay, we've been working only on narrative, but what if we brought in two other corpora, which are not fictional? And so we chose biography, which is not fictional, but it's narrative, and then miscellaneous nonfiction. And we did the same things that we did here, and there is only one chart, there is no point in me showing. And it turns out, and we calculated focus again, and it turned out that the narrative texts were much less thematically focused than biography and way less thematically focused than nonfiction. And it makes sense, because nonfiction, the most focused paragraph in all of our corpus comes from an anatomy book, description of the skeleton of an extinct giant sloth. And, you know, it's a paragraph in which it's only skeleton. And you know, they're taxonomic texts. They're classification texts. Narrative needs classification, but it also changes it. And so, and this is interesting because it means that, again, thematics has a role in the study of narrative, but perhaps one should also remember it's a weaker role than it can play in other types of discourse. This, again, was, you see, surprising. In order to be surprised, and this is a problem with literary theory, but not with our, with literary theory in general, I think. And this is the right place to say this, because it has to do with, indeed, horizons of expectations, etc. Literary theory has very, very few expectations. Literary history, even less. So you are always surprised and never really surprised. It's not like physics that, you know, if I drop this and it floats, that's an enormous surprise because the law of gravity is suspended. We don't have equivalent expectations. So it's always this lukewarm atmosphere, which I find very unpleasant. It would be, and, you know, maybe one of the good results of this type of approach is that you harden your expectations. You say, you know what, paragraphs, 60% of paragraphs have two or three topics. This is a fact. Now, and then if a book turns out to have only paragraphs, then the surprise is real. But, okay, excellent. The first thing, attention span. Yeah, well, okay, we found that paragraphs achieve the, paragraphs are thematically focused between 80 and 200 words. How long does it take to read them? Probably 15, 20 seconds. Is that a unit? When I was studying Ulysses, I remember I studied paragraphs for the first time when working on Ulysses. And paragraphs of stream of consciousness. Stream of consciousness was invented by the term by William James. William James, among other things, while working on what he called stream of consciousness, was studying the present. What does the present mean? And, you know, he was talking of the present as a saddle, not as a, like, you know, a messer, but a saddle. You can sit and look back and forth. And some people even had an idea of measuring the present, place it at 10, 15 seconds. A paragraph in Stream of Consciousness takes a little longer to read, but could it be that the paragraph is a way to organize our sense of the present? Or a unit of time? The present is too loaded as a term to use, but a sense of a segment of time. Indeed, attention span is a broad category, but a type of attention span that we don't know. It's a fantastically good question. A second thing, and here I will go on, about the position of paragraphs. You know, once we had measured all this stuff, we thought, okay, what about the sequence of paragraphs? And so we... See, this is the middle of the floss, and all of the paragraphs, one after the other, how they succeed each other. And our naive hope, as the term sequencing hopelessly reveals, was that, you know, some fantastic pattern of sequence would emerge. Not at all. But now the idea is to actually break this into chapters and see and start using a more manageable scale to see if indeed there is, as you said, a sequence in a chapter from the first paragraph to the last. Novels vary very much. See, this is the other novel. As you can see from just the color spectrum, the type of paragraphs. The only thing that I think can be gauged from these charts is that usually novels tend to alternate paragraphs with a different thematic focus. And it never stays too long with a single type, that the law is one of mixing. But this is not a very satisfying result, but at least, you know, this is what seems to emerge. So yes, indeed, it's that would be one of the next few things that we would like to study. So this topic model that we used, it's called Mallet, builds its topics by not looking at all the words. It eliminates function words, so pronouns, conjunction, prepositions, etc., etc. It eliminates all proper names, and it eliminates words that occur, according to the program, too often. So it, I know, yeah, you're right, you're, oh, look, that's why we never used it. That's why we never used it. But, you know, if you want to do thematic study in the context of digital humanities, this is the universal tool. So the point is not to to mask this state of affairs, it's just to explain what can be done. And you see, then I'll give you again, what we did, precisely because we were aware of these shortcomings, was to use the topics not to study the semantics of the text, because for that purpose they're too sloppy, but only to study the formal structure of the paragraph. So two answers. One is that we've run five different runs of the program, precisely, you know, because we were interested in replicability. And we realized that even though topics changed a little bit and the words that belong to the various topics changed a little bit, the number of topics that define the paragraphs did not. And since we were interested in how the number of topics design different types of paragraph, whether the topic had to do more with the house or more with the garden made no difference for our purposes. But of course, if you want to know whether a certain novel takes place in a house or in a garden, it makes a lot of a difference. That's, as I said, when you cannot change a tool, you have to figure out ways in which it can still be useful, even though it's defective. That's question number one. That's answer number one. The second answer is, it's not mine. It's been given by two people who believe in topic modeling much more than I do. We said, well, look, sure. The program rereads the corpus and comes up with different topics. You reread Middlemarch, and the second time, come up with different ideas. What's the big difference then? This proves, if anything, that the program is human, or that you are... I don't like this answer, but it's a very clever polemical answer. It must be said, right? That's because then it suggests that's where it becomes iffy. It says, well, it means that it's just like a second reading or a third reading changes our understanding of the text. So does, well, yeah, but it changes our understanding of the text. And we can say, the second time I read this novel, all of a sudden I realized that the point was not Vronsky, but it was Levin in Anna Karenina. The program doesn't do that. The program simply changes, but it doesn't construct an argument. We like to think that the second or third reading is perhaps better than the first because it includes it. And well, let's say that the career of professional critics is built on the idea that the more... The program doesn't do that. So the analogy is clearly shaky. But on the other hand, you know, the non-replicability is part of what we deal with. No, it's very simple. When we are interested in semantic analysis, we use a different program, which we call most distinctive words, and which basically has to do with, to begin with, we use that with word frequencies. And basically we get, say we take a corpus of Bildungsromane, a corpus of regional novels, and we get long lists of words that tend to occur with much greater frequency or infrequency in one or the other corpus, and then we work from that, and we construct our own themes or categories ourselves, or we work with sentence structure, or we work with parts of speech, et cetera, et cetera. So we design the kind of unit we want to find. Topic modeling, you cannot do that. You can simply say, find me 10, find me 50. And then you can play with the parameters, but you know it's basically another version of find me 10 or find me 50, and that's why, again, we hardly ever use it. But you know, it's not that we're not interested in semantics; it's that we're not interested in semantics on this basis. And when we try to do computational criticism, which has a semantic focus, then we go in. We use different approaches. That would be my answer, and then that can be refined. Like, you know, can decide, for instance, that you want to figure out the difference, the semantic difference between different parts of a play, direct exchanges as opposed to monologues, etc. So you can, you know, work a lot, but you know, this is not what topic modeling can do. No, no word is 100% belonging to a topic. See, this is, each topic has here, the 50 most frequent words are listed there. And for instance, we saw it in a couple of cases, book or feel are assigned to two different topics, or more actually, probably feel is assigned to 15 different topics. It's just usually the rank is different. But even if the rank is different, then in the specific paragraph, the model assigns it. It has to assign it, or it simultaneously, there are two ways of measuring this. This is why, this is one of the, there are two scores here on the left. The first score, as you know much better than I do, for any portion of the text, all the 50 topics, we use 50 topics, has a non-zero score. Right, because all of them are somehow present, because there will be some words that belong to a certain extent to one of those topics. On the other hand, The other thing that the model did was that it focused on 30 words, 30 of its topically significant words per each paragraph, and those 30 words were only assigned in the score number 2 to one topic. Even though in score number 1, they were assigned 30% to one topic, 20% to another topic, it's just two different scores. And the colored one, in which they're assigned 100% crisply to a single topic, is something that we used to bring the technique a little bit down to earth, our earth, and that of most people here, even though, you know, it's probably less precise than the other score. The two scores, however, in terms of scores, the two scores are always extremely close.